I'm telling these tears go and fall away, fall away. Oh, may the last one burn into flames. Freedom, freedom, I can't move. Welcome, everybody. Happy Friday. My name is Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We've made it through another week, perhaps not without some bruising and whiplash, it seems, especially in the realm of foreign policy. We've got a great show lined up for everyone today. We're going to start out with some of the harder news this afternoon. We're going to talk about Donald Trump's approach to foreign policy, specifically Russia and Ukraine. We've got a great expert for you. At the bottom of this hour, we're going to be joined by an expert on sleep, given that we have to spring forward this weekend. Anybody ever wonder why they don't spring forward Friday at like 4 o'clock? You know, let's just lose an hour of work time as opposed to Sunday morning at 2 a.m. We'll talk about that. We've got, of course, our Ask Maggie segment. And then my colleague Terry Barr joins me at 3:30 for what's good, local, and overlooked in Wisconsin. But let's start on the global stage. I am so excited to see my friend and yours, Professor Yoshiko Herrera from the University of Wisconsin at Madison. She's a professor of political science, expert on Russian politics, nationalism, identity, and ethnic policies. Basically, this lady knows a whole lot about what we're about to talk about. Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show, Yoshiko. It's really a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much. Wonderful to be here.
It was quite, not just the week, which was pretty insane, but it has been quite a span of about 6 weeks. Before I start with some of the questions, I wanted to refresh everyone's recollection about some of the things that have transpired because it has been so very, very, very busy. we had about 2+ weeks ago, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth stating that Ukraine will basically never join NATO. He followed that up shortly thereafter by saying that Ukraine needs to give up any hope of reclaiming the territory lost since Russia's full-scale invasion some many years ago now. That was then subsequently followed by Vice President J.D. Vance appearing in Munich, basically chastising the Western alliance, Western democracies that have been longtime allies of the United States. That then was followed by what can only be described as one of the most disastrous meetings of heads of state in the Oval Office, perhaps in history. Then over the weekend, so this was just this past weekend, Donald Trump announced the ceasing of all military aid to Ukraine. There seemed to be some positive movement when he did his pseudo State of the Union address on Tuesday night, announcing that there had been some outreach from President Volodymyr Zelensky, that peace talks may be moving forward. Of course, then on Wednesday, he announced that he was stopping the sharing of intelligence with Ukraine, a major setback. Yesterday, I can't believe it's every day I have to, these things are happening so quickly. Yesterday announced that he was basically revoking the asylum status of some 24,000 Ukrainians. And between all of these points in time, Russia launched one of its largest missile and drone attacks since the onset of its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, injuring some 10 people, dealing some pretty significant blows. Seemingly in response to that, overnight and then this morning, Donald Trump chastising Russia on social media, announcing that he may impose tariffs. I'm going to take a breath, Professor Herrera, because it has been quite a ride. And within the last hour, Donald Trump stating that Putin will be, quote, more generous in peace talks than, quote, difficult Ukraine. Professor Herrera, let's just start. Have I forgotten anything significant? Because there's simply been so much happening.
Okay. Let me just commend you on that list, because that was a very good, very good summary. Just one little thing I want to note is that the asylum, the issue of Ukrainians in the United States, it's 240,000 Ukrainians who have temporary protected status. Most of those people are here living with family because they evacuate. It's very hard, obviously, to get to the U.S. from Ukraine. And so most of them are living with family. So, yes, 240,000.
I
but he hasn't done it yet. He said he was he was thinking about it.
Yes.
But then they haven't made a decision yet. So I hope that will be one of the things that turns out to be something that could have been really horrible, but didn't end up.
Doesn't actually end up happening.
Yeah.
I want to ask you this fundamental question that occurred to me as, again, this last wave of missile and drone attacks from Russia. Clearly, Russia emboldened by the lack of consistent approach from the Trump administration, to put it mildly, if you want to put it in more stark terms, emboldened by Trump's bear hug of Vladimir Putin, frankly, espousing talking points. Are we at a tipping point? Might Russia attempt to make even more advances, claim more territory in Ukraine, sensing a point of vulnerability, especially if intelligence sharing has indeed ceased? And secondly, this speaks, I think, more broadly to my concern over what are Russia's incentives now if you're going into peace talks? Where are the leverage points?
Yeah.
How do we move forward?
So many people thought that Russia really since December. So December and January, Russia had extremely high losses. Some days in December and January, there were close to 2,000 casualties a day. Now that's dead, missing, and wounded, taken prisoner. Mm-hmm. But that's a lot per day. And December and January were some of the worst months in terms of casualties for Russia. Now, what were they doing? They were trying to take as much territory as they could, anticipating some kind of peace process. So for sure, they thought this is our, I mean, the sanctions have a mixed record. They inflicted some damage, inflicted a lot of long-term damage. But a lot of analysts think Russia could, you know, keep going for another couple of years. But they are facing various problems, inflation, other kinds of things. And so even though everybody wants to predict Russia is about to fall apart quickly, it keeps going. But nevertheless, they understand that in the future, they're probably going to be weaker than they are now. So they're trying to capture as much territory as they can. Ukrainians, for their part, also suffered a lot of casualties, but mostly have held on and only allowed Russia to make some incremental gains over the last, really, more than a year. The front lines haven't changed that much. So there has been a lot, even though it looks like a stalemate, there's actually been a tremendous amount of fighting going on with Russia trying to take as much territory as it can. Now, my thought from the beginning about the peace plan, about the ceasefire, about ending the war in 24 days is, okay, on the one hand, the war could end right now in 5 minutes. Russia could just say, we're done. We're pulling out. It's not a highly complex situation like Syria or Gaza, or like, whose land is it? How are we going to deal with this? Who's going to be there? It's very, very clear. Russia just gets out of Ukraine and the war ends. So, I mean, in that sense, it's not conceptually difficult. But from the beginning of the war, Russia has never moderated its demands. It has never said they want anything less than their maximalist demands of total control over Ukraine, denial of Ukrainian sovereignty, denial of Ukrainian nationhood, no foreign troops in Ukraine, no Ukraine in NATO, et cetera. So that is the problem. It's the problem in my view is not that I want to take sides. It's just like the problem of how the war is going to end is that Russia does not want to end the war. That's my opinion. And what you're seeing with the pressure on Ukraine is it has emboldened Russia to do even more. This really terrible decision to stop sharing intelligence with Ukraine, terrible and heartbreaking, has led, you know, what does that intelligence do? It allows Ukraine to shoot down ballistic missiles from Russia. That's one of the things. It allows them to find long-range targets. And what Russia has done with that is use the opportunity to bomb relentlessly Ukraine even more in the last couple of days than they had been doing before, which was still doing a lot. So that's where the lack of pressure on Russia doesn't lead to less fighting. It leads Russia to more action. However, the sanctions, and especially if we were to put in blocking sanctions against a number of Russian banks, et cetera, if we were to block Russian oil revenue, oil and gas revenue, that could really make a big difference.
It's quite a moment that we find ourselves in with some of the leaders of Western European, again, at least putative allies of the United States looking at actually seizing frozen Russian assets in their banks. I mean, we're at this very precarious point in time. Even yet today, President Trump saying from the Oval Office that Putin did not want to start the war in Ukraine and he wants to end this war. Is there any basis in fact or history, Professor, to support that pretty wild allegation from the current American president?
There's nothing to support the statement that Putin didn't want to start a war, but he may want to end it. I mean, in as favorable terms,
yes.
Yeah, there's a possibility he's feeling the cost, but there's also a possibility he doesn't. He hasn't said he wants to end it, other than apparently to President Trump.
I have a follow-up question that's a little bit more broad in concept. President Trump has been saying, and I think certain U.S. officials, both on the Democratic and Republican side, have been saying that Western Europe needs to do more, both in terms of payments to NATO, which have increased over the last 5 to 6 years, and that they really need to do more to ensure both their individual safety as countries, but also as a bulwark against the Soviet Union. Is there any sort of silver lining here? Is that working to any extent? We've got about a minute, and of course we can finish on the other side if we have to take a breath.
Yes, Europe, there is a sea change in understanding in Europe. I think the break in the Europe U.S. relationship, the U.S.-NATO relationship cannot be overstated. It's a huge, huge change in U.S. International relations over the last 8 years.
Folks,
so Europe is, and Europe understands that. Europe understands it can no longer count on the United States.
Folks, we're going to pick it right back up where we left off. What comes next as the United States adopts an increasingly isolationist posture with all of these global conflicts occurring? More with Professor Yoshiko Herrera of the University of Wisconsin-Madison when we come back right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked. I'ma keep running 'cause the winner don't quit on themselves.